Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Friday night's strike on Assad's alleged chemical weapons sites in Syria by the US, France and the UK, and get an assessment of what was achieved in terms of mission accomplished, which Trump triumphantly tweeted out on Saturday. An expert on Syria, James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA and author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know, joins us along with the Syrian opposition spokeswoman, Rafif Shujati, the founder and director of Free Syria Foundation. We will discuss the extent to which the military action was largely cosmetic and theatrical in nature, given that empty buildings and bunkers were destroyed. But on the other hand, it does appear that General Mattis won out over the hawks, Trump and Bolton, in limiting the strikes so that no Russians were killed, which, if there had been Russian casualties, a wider war with catastrophic consequences might have ensued. We will also examine the moral blindness of Nikki Haley's threat that the US is locked and loaded if Assad uses chemical weapons again, since Assad is free to bomb hospitals and use barrel bombs and starvation on his people because the U.S. has no policy when it comes to all other aspects of the Syrian war. Then we will speak with veteran investigative journalist Peter Stone about the bombshell story he broke at McClatchy. Mueller has evidence Cohen was in Prague in 2016, confirming part of dossier. He joins us to discuss the significance of the trip by Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to Prague in the fall of 2016 during the presidential campaign, just after Manafort was fired, to meet with a top Russian official close to Putin and a group of hackers who were reported to have been paid for hacking the DNC and the emails of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. Then finally, as Americans file their taxes due on Tuesday, we will examine how we are the least taxed amongst the advanced nations, yet feel the most burdened by taxes. The former Chief of Staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at USC and author of We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, joins us to discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times. Tax policy is a bore until they take your Social Security and Medicare away, and the profligate spending of taxpayer money by Trump and his cabinet, in particular by Scott Pruitt. And joining us now is James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East and particularly Greater Syria. He is the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. And also joining us is Rafif Shujati, who is with the Syrian Women's Political Movement. She's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation. She was also the English spokeswoman for the local coordinating committees in Syria. And she frequently travels to the Middle East, including Syria, and coordinates with other activists to take actions and inform the public about events in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Gelvin and Rafif Shujati.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you, Rafif. And James, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So let me begin with you, James. I mentioned in the opening that I thought this attack on Syria by the U.S., France, and the U.K. was largely cosmetic. As far as I know, these buildings were pretty much empty. That's sort of, I guess, the bad news, if you will. The good news is that apparently the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, was able to win the day against Trump and Bolton, who wanted a much more robust attack, if you will. Mattis had tried to talk him out of it, but then Trump tweeted out how our beautiful missiles were coming, and that could have basically locked us into doing something. So what's your understanding about the prelude to this in terms of the hawks versus the doves within the Trump administration?
Well, first of all, let me just say that it's a pretty pathetic day when we have to say that a reasonable voice is quieting those people who would really risk a war, a direct war with Russia at the present time over Syria. That's certainly not in anybody's interest. It's not in our interest. It's not in the Syrian population's interest either. I think that the problem with the attack, the overall problem with the attack, was the Russian angle and the fact that it cannot be used as a, or the attack will not be seen as a deterrent simply because the United States had to carefully calibrate what it was going to do. It had to be a little bit more than the pinprick of 2017 on the one hand, but it couldn't be enough to get the Russians more involved in a confrontation with the United States. In other words, we couldn't target Russians, we couldn't target Russian aircraft, we couldn't target Russian air bases, and so on and so forth. Now, anybody following the Civil War would know full well that the Syrian army is fairly depleted at the present time and is very much dependent upon Russian air power, Russian military, Iranian-backed militias made up of Iranians, Afghans, Pakistanis, et cetera, et cetera. So that by taking on, by actually doing something that would be powerful, would send a powerful message, would be to risk a wider confrontation. And there's one more thing as well, which is by degrading the military that's against the opposition. This is a cruel irony here, because the Assad regime is in the catbird seat at the present time. They are winning this civil war. And by putting them back on their heels, knocking them back on their heels, what very likely would happen would be a prolongation of Syria's suffering.
Well, I'm sure Rafif has a different opinion because for the longest time we've spoken a lot over the years, Rafif, as this country has been destroyed before our eyes and millions have been displaced and at least 500,000 have died and the country has all but been destroyed. What's your reaction?
Well, let me start by presenting a very Syrian perspective. We don't call this a civil war. We call this a genocidal regime that started by attacking peaceful protests and allowed things to get militarized. So I just want to set the record straight from a Syrian perspective. In terms of the strike, I agree it's just a pinprick, and I believe the Trump administration is at fault for not having a sustainable Syria strategy. And this is much like his predecessor in the Obama administration, who drew red lines but took no action. But again, from a Syrian perspective, if I am hunkered down in a basement waiting for chemical weapons to drop on me and my family, I am elated that somebody did something, that the international community has displayed even a farce of a conscience when we look at the humanitarian situation, when we look at the military situation or the political situation on the ground in Syria. We see that the international community has done little to nothing to stop the killing. And for most Syrians, this is a welcome change.
And James, my understanding is that, first of all, going back to what Rafif said in the beginning, when the people rose up, part of the Arab Spring, which you've written about in your book, The Arab Uprisings, the Syrian military under Assad was ordered to fire on peaceful demonstrators. Many of them didn't want to do that. And then Assad brought in the Iranians, the Revolutionary Guards. And I understand that in many ways they are really in many ways the tail that's wagging the dog, if not the dog that's wagging the tail. Even the Russians are a little uncomfortable that that the Iranians may well have been behind this gas attack. What's your understanding?
Well, I haven't heard that. Before I begin, let me just say that, you know, I fully applaud with Rafi's voice and the actions that she's taken and also the local coordinating committees. I think that, you know, this is something that is extraordinarily important, particularly for those of us in the United States to understand that there have been groups, there still are groups on the ground in Syria that are committed to a democratic Syria in the future, Syria without Bashar al-Assad. As far as the other things are concerned, I think that at the present time, we're really in an endgame scenario, and that's the unfortunate aspect of what's going on in Syria. Nikki Haley, for example, brought up the possibility of restarting the Geneva process. The Geneva process Bringing everybody together, opposition, government, outside players, it's over. And what appears to be going on right now is the efficacy of a very different process that has eliminated the United States, but involves Russia, Iran, and Turkey, all of whom have their own separate interests in Syria as well. The Russians undoubtedly are not completely wedded to Bashar al-Assad, but they are completely wedded to the idea that a regime that might replace Bashar al-Assad is going to have to be pro-Russian, will not be allowed to be within an American or Western orbit, and which means, of course, will not be allowed to have a free and fair future.
And Rafif, when you mentioned that at least something was done, is there anything more that could be done? I mean, do you disagree with what James is saying, that Assad seems to be winning here? And, you know, to put it bluntly, your side has lost.
Well, so there's multiple questions here. I don't necessarily disagree with the good professor, and I thank you, sir, for the shout-out for the LCC and other nonviolent groups on the ground. I want to go back to the question of the political process. The formal opposition and much of the international community has been talking about a political solution to the problem that is Syria. Unfortunately, the major issue is that we do not have a partner with which or with whom to negotiate. The Assad regime has made it extremely clear that they are not going to negotiate themselves out of power. So we want a political solution. We believe that to sustain a future democracy, we need a political solution and a political transition. Unfortunately, the regime that yields chemical weapons, whether by the Russian dog or the Iranian tail, irrelevant. The fact is, it's a regime that does use chemical weapons, that does use barrel bombs and starvation sieges against a civilian population. And that fact tells us that there cannot be a political solution with such a partner. And so, unfortunately, many of us, particularly in the nonviolent community, are starting to feel that there is only a military solution and that the Assad regime needs to be taken out. In terms of collaboration with Russia or relations with Russia in the future, as far as I know, the opposition has not had a problem with maintaining strong ties with Russia or assuring Russia of its continued interest in Syria. The problem is the Assad regime and the apparatus, the security apparatus that surrounds it, and the basic fundamental issue of authoritarianism.
Well, given that the current situation and the trajectory, though, Rafif, what's your sense then of what leverage could be used, given that this was, I think, to be you know, fair, I think it was pretty cosmetic and rather theatrical. I don't know that very much was achieved, but at the least, you know, a marker was laid down on chemical weapons. As I mentioned in the opening, Nikki Haley says we're locked and loaded if they do it again. Well, what about all the other horrors that happen on a daily basis? You know, we don't have a policy. So do we have a post-Assad policy? I mean, who's going to pay for the reconstruction?
Right, right. So, you know, when Nikki Haley says we're locked and loaded, this doesn't necessarily indicate much more than bluster, at least to me. And it's unfortunate that the administration is using this kind of language, because I think it's argumentative and belligerent without necessarily having teeth. However, I've got to say, going back to the whole concept of the political process and this most recent strike in Syria, what the message is we're willing to strike in the event of chemical weapons. However, barrel bombs, starvation sieges, cluster bombs, and maybe chlorine attacks are permissible. And this is the tragedy in Syria. Everything is permissible except this sarin gas or mustard gas is not. All other means of killing civilians are allowed.
And James Galvin, What do you understand then is going on with Trump and the Russians? Because it seemed that just recently, Trump, when he was doing a stump speech in Ohio, said, we're going to get out of Syria. And that caught a lot of people by surprise, least of all the Kurds, who would be very vulnerable if the U.S. pulled out those 2,000 special forces. And my understanding is that Trump was furious with Assad and with Putin because of this chemical attack, because he'd already signaled that he wanted to get out. And rather than, you know, cooperate with Trump, Assad goes ahead and takes advantage of what he perceives as a weakness on our part. Is that you think, what happened? I don't know what's going on in terms of communications between the two, but these sanctions that have just been levied against Russia apparently crashed the stock exchange in Russia last week. They really are biting, and Nikki Haley's now promising on Monday that there'll be more sanctions coming.
Well, you know, the Trump administration has been very quick to blame Obama and backing away from the red line. We tend to forget, of course, that there wasn't the votes in Congress probably to allow for a passage of a bill that would enable an attack on Syria as a result of that. But if you look actually at the sequencing of events, it's possible to flip what you said on its head, which was that when Trump announced that the 2,000 American troops that are in Syria now will be withdrawn, it's very possible that this was done in a response to that, either Bashar al-Assad saying, okay, game's over, I don't have to worry about the Americans anymore, or actually needling Trump intentionally with this sort of thing, which, of course, Trump is very, very vulnerable to. So I'm not quite sure where this thing is going. When Trump mentioned or tweeted mission accomplished, the problem is that he mistakes a tactical operation for a mission. There is no mission in Syria. There's only a tactical operation and maybe another tactical operation and maybe a third tactical operation. But we have really no Syria policy. It's arguable that at least under Obama, there was a broader Middle East policy that unfortunately got sidetracked through a whole variety of things, the uprisings, what took place in Syria, and what have you. But it's also very likely that the only policy that we have right now in the Middle East in its entirety is that Trump looks around and sees what Obama did and then decides to become the un-Bama, decides to take a totally different tack. So Obama walked away from his red line. Trump, crosses the, Trump attacks when Syria crosses the red line. Trump befriends the very people that Obama alienated, the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Israelis, and so on. So I think that that is the only foundation that we can say is guiding the Trump administration at the present time to just reverse everything that their predecessor had attempted to do.
And Rafif, what do you expect going forward now? Will Assad turn his attention to the last holdout in Idlib?
Absolutely. I think if you look at the forced displacements that have been taking place, how anybody in the opposition, including civilians, have been moved to Idlib, I believe that's going to be the site of the next part of this ongoing genocide. I think we can expect to see more chemical weapons in play. I think we can expect to see what have the weapons that have become normal, the barrel bombs, et cetera, the targeting of hospitals and markets and other civilian structures. I think it's basically a movie that we keep rewinding and playing over and over. And in the end, we're going to continue to talk about a political solution. We're going to continue to talk about strategy or lack of strategy. And I would agree with James. What we have is tactical moves coming out of the United States as opposed to a mature and well-thought-out strategy. And I think we're simply going to see more of the same. It's a tragedy for humanity that this kind of genocide is allowed.
So, James, just a quick last-minute comment, if you will.
You know, I think that unfortunately, in 6 months or 8 months, we're going to view this particular thing as a tempest in a teapot. The big news is stuff that's going on around it. The big news is the fact that, again, we don't have a Middle East strategy, or the fact that 40 innocent civilians died in this chemical attack, which was horrific. 31,000 innocent civilians died in Aleppo during the siege of Aleppo. And Rafif is absolutely right. There were barrel bombs that were used then. There were cluster bombs that were used then. There were incendiary weapons that were used then. And yet the world remains silent.
Rafif, a quick last comment, if you will.
I mean, I don't know that I can add anything more. I appreciate the fact that you're covering it. I wish more media would focus on sort of the irrationality of living in a world where we have near real-time communications and we're watching people get slaughtered. We are literally watching this ongoing atrocity and doing nothing. I don't know what to leave you with, Ian, other than a thank you for trying to put a spotlight on this tragedy.
Well, Rafif Shuiati, I thank you very much for joining us. Again, Rafif is with the Syrian Women's Political Movement. She's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation. And James Galvin is a professor of history at UCLA and the author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, did visit Prague. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Stone, a special correspondent, former Clatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal, and campaign finance issues in Washington. He began his career at the California-based magazine Ramparts, and he's the author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. And he has an article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon. Mueller has evidence Cohen was in Prague in 2016, confirming part of dossier. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Stone.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Well, Peter, you have really thrown a cat amongst the pigeons with this story that you've broken about Cohen being in Prague, which he has vociferously denied. It's key to the Mueller inquiry in the sense that it was a part of the Steele dossier, an important part. And we can talk about the details outlined in the Steele dossier, which, if verified, would be devastating. But Donald Trump is already tweeting out this morning a furious fusillade of tweets. Attorney-client privilege is now a thing of the past. I have too many lawyers, and they are probably wondering when their offices, even their homes, are going to be raided with everything, including their phones and computers, taken. All lawyers are deflated and concerned. Well, apparently on Friday, Cohen's lawyer, before the judge, made such a poor case trying to say that the judge wanted to know whether Cohen's a lawyer or a fixer. If he's a fixer, then attorney-client privilege is irrelevant. And, of course, Cohen's lawyer was trying to get all of the evidence back that was seized by the FBI. The judge was so frustrated, she demanded that Cohen show up at 2 o'clock on Monday in her court to basically answer the basic question, are you a lawyer or are you a fixer? It's looking more and more like he's a fixer, isn't it?
Well, we're not reporting on that per se, but
no.
You know, he has a reputation of being the guy who Trump turned to for both business and personal crises. And that includes what we now know about the hush money that went to Stormy Daniels and the payment that went to the other woman, Karen McDougal, which he had a role in negotiating, apparently, or a role in arranging vis-a-vis the National Enquirer. You know, a lot of what he's done over the years has been to take on legal problems for Trump, where he's been in messes. The ones with the women are right front and center now. And he's also been somebody who's gone on the tube and been a sort of tough, aggressive defender of the president. Sometimes he's been known as the pit bull also. I think he may have even been referred to, I'm sure, in stories as a pit bull for Trump. And that was part of what he was doing in the 2016 campaign, when he did not have an official role on the campaign, but did some media and was notable for, you know, sort of taking off the gloves in television appearances and being very aggressive, basically. So I think what came out in terms of the court documents, or what has been reported in the last few days, is that he apparently had very few real legal clients and did minimal amounts of legal work. But that's a lot to be discovered on that. We don't know all of that by any means yet. And that's, again, not what our story was really focused on. So I'm
sure. Well, I was just kept trying to start with a broader context of who this man is and what his role is,
right,
vis-a-vis Trump. But the point about your story, it's thrown a light on the very heart of the Mueller inquiry, where Trump has repeatedly said that there is no evidence of collusion. And the Steele dossier says that Cohen met in Prague with Konstantin Kosachev, who is an ally of Vladimir Putin's. He's the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Duma. And the meeting, according to the Steele dossier, was essentially with a bunch of hackers. It looks as if the deal was to pay the hackers. They already had hacked the DNC, I think, at that point, and perhaps even Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. And the key to Mueller's inquiry is to make the link between the hacking and how it ended up on WikiLeaks. So this is huge. So tell us what you can about what you know about.
What we reported, and I think it's important that we not overstate it at this stage, what we reported is that the special counsel has evidence now that Cohen did make a secret trip to Prague in late summer, as the Steele dossier first alleged. We don't have the precise dates, but the Steele dossier indicated it was late August, early September, and that seems to be the time frame that our sources who told us about this information believe is correct.
2016,
correct. Right after Manafort, or around the time Manafort resigned from the campaign because of growing press revelations that he had ties to a pro-Russian government in Ukraine, that had worked for a pro-Russian government, had lobbied for a pro-Russian government, and had gotten enormous payments from a government. A lot of the Manafort stuff was known and had been reported on, but there were some new disclosures in early August that really rattled the campaign and forced them to do a kind of, overhaul there. And Manafort resigned, or was pushed out, or a combination of the two. That was on August 19th. This meeting appears to have happened right in that time frame, a little after or early September. And, our sources have confirmed that the Justice Department now has evidence that he did go into the Czech Republic, which was a big stumbling block in confirming this, because there was no evidence of that previously. But they've ascertained they entered through Germany, and would not have needed at that point, if he came in through Germany, if he transited through Germany, because of a zone where you're allowed to travel freely without getting your passport stamped in Europe. That would allow him to enter the Czech Republic without showing a Czech stamp on his passport. And so That's what we know now. We do not have confirmed yet, absolutely do not have confirmed that he did meet with the Russians, but what we did learn certainly gives a lot of credence to that part of the dossier, because Cohn has vigorously denied for months since the dossier came out that he was ever in Prague. That's been a mantra of Cohn's now for over a year. And he's had different pieces of, he's provided a couple of pieces of information to rebut those critics, to rebut that those reports. He said he was in L.A. with his son, being the principal one. But the amount of time he spent in L.A., according to what he's talked about publicly, does not undercut or does not obviate the very real time period here we're talking about, of 3 or 4 weeks, when this trip, you know, appears to have taken place. His presence in L.A. was limited, in other words. So he hasn't really fully rebutted that. People in Congress who heard his testimony on the House and Senate Intelligence Committee were told have more questions. They think they need more documents to verify his testimony, his denials that he was in Prague, the skepticism in Congress about this as well. And we report on that very briefly in this story, too. So I think Mueller's going to, you know, this is going to give an impetus to, if this can be fully fleshed out and proved, it would be a pretty stark example of collusion if it can be fully fleshed out and proved.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Stone, who's a special correspondent for McClatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal, and campaign finance issues in Washington. He began his career at the California-based magazine Ramparts, and he is the author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. And he has an article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon. Mueller has evidence Cohen was in Prague in 2016, confirming part of dossier. And, of course, the dossier alleges that Cohen and the Russians, including the senior figure close to Putin, head of the Duma Foreign Affairs Committee, and these Eastern European hackers, I believe they were Romanian, met at this Russian government-backed social and cultural club in Prague, and that they were, according to the Steele dossier, they were concerned about making deniable cash payments, and that there was some concern on the part of the Russians about their links being exposed, and that, of course, involved a Russian Kalugin. I think he was basically here in Washington as one of their top spies, and he was recalled from the Russian embassy in Washington last August.
August 2016, right. Almost the same time. You mean August 2016. Yeah, that was another... that was another embarrassing or potentially explosive incident that occurred at that time, which the dossier talked about, and we confirmed a good bit of that part, actually.
Mm.
So there are, you know, obviously more things to learn about. We don't know anything. We don't know where the hackers were from. Steele reported Eastern Europe. We don't have the exact names or number. And, you know, he outlined some topics that his sources told him were part of the discussion. But there's more that needs to be nailed down on that, absolutely.
Well, I would think, though, that the reporting that you and Greg Gordon have done in your article, Mueller has evidence Cohen was in Prague in 2016, confirming part of dossier, would indicate that Mueller has an awful lot more than what you were able to find out.
Presumably, he's working aggressively on this, yes. And this is a, you know, if he can nail this down, this would be a major revelation.
Well, the fact of the matter is that Cohen, he wanted to have a bigger role, did he not, in the campaign than just Trump's fixer. And he was sort of pushed out by others. But he did try and set up a peace plan with Russia and the U.S. over Ukraine, essentially to forgive the Russians for their annexation of Crimea and invasion of Ukraine. This peace plan was the brainchild of a Ukrainian legislator, pro-Russian, Andriy Artemenko, So he was out working actively. He was also working with Felix Sater, the mobbed up guy that worked in the Trump Organization, who did a little PR blitz recently. They were trying to build Trump Tower in Moscow, were they not? So he was pretty active in that summer during the campaign, was he not? And he made at least three trips to Europe that we know of.
Right, right. Well, those other pieces you just mentioned are of interest, I believe, to Mueller. His role in the peace plan, which was a very short-lived effort that was floated right around the time of Trump's inaugural. Cohen did have a meeting in New York with his legislator, the Ukrainian legislator, who apparently was the point man for this peace plan. It was a rather pro-Russian tilt to the plan. Nobody took it very seriously, but Cohen did have a meeting with Artemenko, and Sater was part of that meeting. And Cohen provided rather contradictory accounts of what he did almost immediately when it was first reported. He told the New York Times that broke this story that he actually delivered the plan, put it on the desk of then National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. This was weeks before Flynn, you know, was ousted. He first claimed that to the New York Times, and then when other papers tried to follow up on the story, within days, Cohen switched the story and said, no, I never delivered it to the White House, undercutting his credibility on this, I would say, as well. So Sater and he, who had known each other for years, did have a role in that plan, which didn't go very far. They also were working together months prior to that during the campaign in terms of trying to float a project to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. And this was in late 2015. There were discussions about this, and it also never got off the ground, but there was talk within the Trump Organization. Trump himself signed a letter of intent to do something with this to try and make it go forward. The whole financing and arrangements for it are very, what we know about it, are very skimpy at this date. So that, Coney said the idea died a few months later in early 2016.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Stone, who's a special correspondent, former Clatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal, and campaign finance issues in Washington. He began his career at the California-based magazine Ramparts, and he is the author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. And he has an article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon. Mueller has evidence Cohen was in Prague in 2016, confirming part of dossier. So just in closing, Peter Stone, presumably this extraordinary amount of information that's both tapes, hard drives, laptops, phones, files, emails, they've got up to 30 years of stuff, apparently, the FBI raid. They really was a very thorough raid, apparently. Do you think it's possible that within all of that material there'll be some evidence that will buttress what you're reporting?
It's possible that there will be some evidence related to the areas that Mueller is focused on. We should emphasize that the raid was done by the Southern District of New York. Mueller turned this matter over to them, prosecutors in New York, to handle this because the focus of the raid was primarily on non-Russia-related matters, looking into Cohen's role in his business, Cohen's role in the payment to Stormy Daniels, and some of his business dealings. He had a taxi cab company for many years that's under scrutiny. So that was the focus of it, but it's quite possible there will be other evidence there. And if there is evidence there, legal experts, ex-prosecutors say that, you know, there's a high good chance that this could be then turned over to Mueller. There'd be no reason or a good possibility that Mueller would get his hands on evidence that relates to the Russia issues that were the focus of his probe, collusion in the campaign. and Russian meddling in 2016.
Well, it is an extraordinary coincidence, just in closing, that Michael Cohen is married to a Ukrainian. So, of course, is Paul Manafort. Of course, Manafort's partner in the Ukraine turned out to be a GRU, Russian military intelligence officer, his right-hand man. The ties, both familial and political and financial, are pretty evident, are they not?
Well, there are a variety of ties. I mean, Manafort's are certainly different than the Cohen's ties. Manafort spent almost a decade there on and off working for pro-Russian political party government and pro-Russian oligarchs. So it's a different situation. But, you know, Cohen does have some connections, obviously, to the Ukraine. And, you know, his business is under scrutiny. You know, his old business, the taxi cab business. And, you know, I think there's a lot more to come out on several fronts.
Well, Peter Stone, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
I do. And again, I've been speaking with Peter Stone. He's a special correspondent for McClatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal, and campaign finance issues in Washington. He began his career at the California-based magazine Ramparts and is the author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. And he has an article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon. Mueller has evidence Cohen was in Prague in 2016, confirming part of dossier. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back on this tax day looking into how we are the most undertaxed of the advanced nations. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. He served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Tax Policy is a Bore Until They Take Your Social Security and Medicare Away. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Thank you very much, Ian, for inviting me.
Well, thank you. And, of course, today is April the 15th, tax day. Because it's on a Sunday, people can file up until Tuesday, right? The deadline is
yes.
What time on Tuesday? Do you know, Ed?
As late as your post office is open.
Okay, well.
As long as it's postmarked Tuesday.
So, but of course, in your op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, you make the case that for all of our tax resistance and dislike of the IRS and the Grover Norquists of this world talking about shrinking the government down to the point where it can be drowned in a bathtub, at the end of the day, the reality is, the facts are in our this environment of fake news, the facts are that we are perhaps the least taxed of all of the advanced nations on this planet.
You know, that's absolutely right. And it may be the longest running fake news story in history because it goes back a couple of centuries now. We believe ourselves to be terribly overburdened by taxes. But when you benchmark the United States against the other advanced economies, you see that's simply not true. We have a different mix of taxes. You know, we rely more on the income tax and less on national sales tax that most countries have, called a value-added tax. But in terms of the total tax collections, federal, state, and local, as a percentage of our national income, we're way below where other advanced economies are. And, of course, the new tax bill is going to reduce that still further.
Well, what I find particularly irksome now is that we have the Republicans controlling the House and the Senate and the White House, and they just pushed through a massive tax cut for the wealthy, which is going to blow out the deficits. And this is the party that's also crippled the IRS by cutting their enforcement down to the point where they're having difficulty collecting taxes. So I don't understand at the end of the day what they're doing in terms of how do you run a country without revenues? I mean, what's at the heart of that apart from perhaps the libertarian dogma of people like the Koch brothers?
Well, I think that what's going on is a very conscious, so the two-step tango, of which the first step is to slash tax revenues, which we've just seen, and the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says that after taking into account growth effects of the new law, it will add almost $2 trillion to our deficits over the next 10 years. So the first step of the tango is to slash taxes. The second step is to sort of shrug your shoulders and say, what are you going to do? We have no choice but to slash the social safety net because there's no money in the till. But the reason there's no money in the till is because we've chosen not to put any there, because we've chosen to undertax ourselves. And so the ultimate agenda is to dismantle the fundamental safety nets that have been in place since the New Deal era to radically cut back on Social Security, on Medicare, on Medicaid, and so on. And in doing so, assure a comfortable life to those whom the marketplace is rewarded, and you know, to return us to a very unhappy life for those of us who don't have millions of dollars in the bank at the time of our retirement.
But we've seen this movie before. It happened under Ronald Reagan. He ran up the deficits by increasing defense spending by enormous amounts. His own budget director, David Stockman, pointed this out and had to be taken behind the woodshed for a spanking, as you probably recall.
I do.
So, and then, of course, that was the MO. You know, you cut taxes, run up the deficits, foreclose any spending apart from defense spending. Isn't that exactly what Donald Trump is doing? Massive increases in defense spending, offset by cuts on social programs.
I think that's exactly right. And that's why it's not correct to look at the tax bill in isolation, because taxes are just how we pay for the government we really want. The question is, what's the government we really want? What does that look like in terms of the kinds of programs that we all want to offer all of us collectively, and then how are we going to pay for them? So this two-step dance that is underway is ideologically driven, in my view, and it's aimed at essentially strangling the middle class. It's aimed at asphyxiating the working class by ultimately taking the social safety net on which the majority of Americans rely and saying we can no longer afford it. So it's not ultimately about taxes. It's ultimately about dismantling the New Deal era social programs on which our lives as a nation are collectively premised.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart. He's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. He served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Tax Policy is a Bore, Until They Take Your Social Security and Medicare Away. Now, when you say it's a two-step, as you've described what's going on, and of course it's been going on since Ronald Reagan, and it's gotten a new boost under Donald Trump. But there's a three-step, if you will, aspect to it that I find particularly galling, is that the Trump administration has been perhaps the most profligate in spending taxpayer money. We are subsidizing Scott Pruitt's detail of 20 bodyguards and all of the refurbishing of his offices with a soundproof room, and of course the furniture that the Secretary of HUD tried to have installed there, which he denied and had to admit, trying to blame it on his wife. This is a pretty tacky bunch. I mean, and the president himself. I mean, every time he goes to Mar-a-Lago, it costs a fortune. I think the Secret Service spent something like $100,000 renting golf carts alone. That money, by the way, goes to Trump. To my mind, is that this is particularly galling because these are the people who are running this jihad against government itself. At the same time, they're slopping about in the trough, fat and happy like pigs.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth there, Ian, to what you say. My intuition, nobody can read the mind of Donald Trump, because I don't think there's any center to it. But as best I can tell, he's not an ideologue. I do think that Paul Ryan is ideologically driven. I do think that the Koch brothers and others are ideologically driven. And so there is that difference. And the ideology is this view that private markets supply all solutions to all people all of the time. The corruption issues that you identify, say, with Scott Pruitt, they're very real, but they're not directly important from a tax and spending point of view when you remember that the government today spends a total of $3 trillion a year. So that's $3,000 billion a year. The reason why Scott Pruitt, why the Pruitt-type spending is so upsetting is because it's evidence of a fundamentally corrupt individual. It's evidence of a person with contempt for the rule of law, with somebody who has contempt for the processes of government, somebody whom, as you say, is a pig at the trough of government, feeding himself and his cronies. And in that environment, these items are evidence of, first, of a man who's narcissistic and paranoid and corrupt. But it's not the dollars themselves, to me, that are as important as it is that this is a window into a behavior where the larger issues of his efforts to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency should be our larger focus. You know, I'm in a minority here, I guess, but if we send senior State Department people from Washington to Singapore, let's say, to negotiate a revised version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I don't mind that they fly business class so they get a night's sleep so that they can be functional when they get off the plane. I don't think that we actually serve our national interests by telling the senior State Department people to sit in the back of the plane when they're going to negotiate something so important the minute they get off the plane. But what's galling about the Pruitt expedition to Africa a few months ago is that it served no purpose at all. The EPA had no involvement of any kind in liquefied natural gas policy of the United States. It served only the direct commercial interests of one of his sponsors. That's the galling part of that story.
Sure. And, of course, what is even more galling is that Scott Pruitt might well be the next attorney general. Now that Trump has conducted his raid on Syria and might well go up in the polls, as he did a year ago when he fired cruise missiles at Syria, may well be a prime opportunity for him, with a boost in the polls, to find a way to fire Rod Rosenstein and get rid of the Mueller investigation. And the rumor is that Scott Pruitt might be put in there under the Vacancies Act. And, of course, Scott Pruitt, I think the most outrageous thing was that apparently he was going to a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and he ordered his security detail to turn the sirens on because they were running late. And the security officer with him said that, no, that's against protocol. We can only turn on the sirens when there's a real emergency. And guess what? Scott Pruitt fired him. So,
well, exactly. And that's evidence of a fundamentally corrupt nature and a fundamentally narcissistic nature and a predilection to cronyism and corruption. That's evidence of all of that, which is deeply troubling.
Right.
And reasons for him to be fired. But the dollars and cents, of course, you know, the cost of running the siren or the tax revenues is not the story.
Sure. Well,
so much as it is the evidence of corruption.
Right. Just so in the last minute then, with people paying their taxes, so what should they do to right the ship?
Well, they should elect a better class of congressmen in general, is the short answer. You know, taxes are famously described as, you know, the price we pay for a civilized society. And we seem to have decided to turn our back on this idea that we want and can afford to live in a civilized society. It's as if we want to live under the law of the jungle. We want to live lives that are nasty, brutish, and short, as Thomas Hobbes said, and we want to get to obtain nothing of the learning of the last 200 years of the benefits of living in a civilized society in which we acknowledge our respective obligations to each other, as well as the opportunities that a market economy can offer. So we're completely out of balance in our national psyche today.
Well, Edward Kleinbart, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. And he served as the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Tax Policy is a Bore Until They Take Your Social Security and Medicare away. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Kathleen Ash. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time will pass.